The Myth and Propaganda of Black Buying Power, a second edition of which is due to be published early next year. Jared also hosts the podcast I Mix What I Like, and he's a co-founder of blackpowermedia.org. His decades of journalism, media, writing, and political work can be found at imixwhatilike.org. And we spoke to Jared earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you, though. I mean, tell us about Marcus Garvey and what the Anti-Defamation League, often referred to by its abbreviations, ADL, has to say about him.
Well, Garvey was a hero of the Jamaican nation. And in the film, there was a photograph of a monument to him, which is currently exists in Jamaica. But he was attacked by organisations like the ADL, including the ADL, as far back as the 1930s. He died in 1940. He was regarded as being an anti-Semite. And of course, they didn't pay any attention to his role in a kind of pan-Africanist consciousness, the raising of self-respect amongst black people in the US, and the arguments about what should happen in relation to racism. And of course, it was emblematic of the way in which the ADL and indeed other Zionist organizations in the US targeted anyone who stood up for black civil rights or who argued against racism.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, well, we asked Jared what he made of our report on the ADL's activities in the black community.
Well, the ADL's activities are pretty consistent with their class and ideological or political positioning. And as part of representing the interests of the state, so to speak, they align themselves perfectly well with all of the state's suppressive elements.
David, of course, Frantz Fanon, wrote the seminal Wretched of the Earth and was active in the Algerian liberation movement, wasn't he? I mean, what was the ADL's gripe with him?
Well, it's one of the first instances, really, of the attempt to blur together anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. So they called him an anti-Semite, but what they were really condemning, and they say this explicitly, was his opposition to the imperialist state of Israel. It's a quote from one of their documents. So, you know, I mean, Fanon was, of course, involved with the FLN and the decolonization of Algeria. The Israelis, of course, as we know from previous shows, were involved on the other side and working with the settlers and with their death squads to target the liberation movement. So there's a very clear sense again here that this is about challenges to Israeli foreign policy interests, which of course is what the ADL was involved in from a very, very early age, you know, to actually pursue the foreign policy interests of the State of Israel, as opposed to pursuing what they were supposed to be pursuing, which is alleged anti-Semitism.
Well, we also asked Jared what the reaction to Malcolm X was from the white society in general, and specifically from the Zionist lobby.
White America was and remains, I would argue, terrified of the actual Malcolm that existed, and which is why so much effort is ongoing to posthumously even rebrand him as somebody he wasn't, because his politics and his capabilities remain terrifying to those in power. So, again, the ADL and the Zionist efforts themselves part of a white supremacist, settler, colonialist, capitalist international apparatus targeted Malcolm just as the rest of that apparatus would, which was to, again, falsely define him, misinterpret him, rebrand and represent him in a way that stood against his actual politics and efforts, which of course involved all manner of what I and many others would consider greatness of socialism, pan-Africanism, anti-colonialism among them.
David, there's a long list of black activists who've been spied on by the Anti-Defamation League. I mean, I wonder, are there any black groups that they didn't spy on?
Well, as you say, a very, very long list. I mean, practically everyone who you've ever heard of who's been a leader of a black anti-racist organisation in the US has been spied upon.
Astonishing.
But the key question here is whether they thought that these organisations could be penetrated and mobilised towards their interests. Mm. So, for example, with Dr. King's organisation, Martin Luther King's organisation, they tried to work with that organisation. They tried to penetrate that organisation and make sure it wouldn't be critical of Israel. They had some success with Dr. King.
Indeed.
In some respects on that. But they were still his organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Organization, was spied upon by the ADL, as was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which is very close to Dr. King. Back in the early 60s, moved away from it and especially split from it over the question of Palestine. So they wanted to penetrate those organizations, which they could do, to make sure they had a blind spot on Palestine. But they couldn't do that. They were denounced as anti-Semitic.
Jared then told us about the stance of Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam to the ADL.
Well, here I would think there's a little bit of a difference, because the politics of Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam differ greatly, particularly on some of the isms I just mentioned. Whereas the Nation of Islam, even elements of the Garvey movement aspired to some sort of level of black capitalism, which is decidedly apart and more centrist than the politics of Malcolm and many others to his left. They were still seen as threats to the establishment simply on the basis of their condemnation of the white supremacist nature of the state, of the treatment of black people, of the suppression of Islam and variations of black nationalism, which are and remain important to black liberation. But there is a difference and a nuance here in terms of how the ADL and other elements of the state look to suppress various elements, on the other hand, of the black community and its liberation movement.
Well, thanks for that. Let's just pause there for a moment. This report about how the Anti-Defamation League has been spying on black activists in recent times.
From spying on Desmond Tutu for the South African apartheid regime to smearing Mark Lamont Hill and Ilhan Omar, the Anti-Defamation League sure does get around. In fact, it was found that the cagey organization had spied on at least 10,000 activists in 700 organizations across 7 U.S. cities. At the same time it was spying on Desmond Tutu and selling the information to the apartheid regime, Israeli political figure Shimon Peres was attempting to arm minority white rule in South Africa with nuclear weapons. In 1968, the FBI began officially collaborating with the ADL, with the director of the government agency informing all branches to directly liaise with their regional leaders of the lobby group. This was, of course, simultaneous to the FBI's war against the black community known as COINTELPRO. Was the ADL involved in this shabby conspiracy too? This level of cooperation between the FBI and the ADL did not stop an internal memo by the agency in 1969 from questioning if the ADL worked for Israel. The now declassified document reads, "It is felt incredible to assume the information is not furnished to an official of the government of Israel. It is believed it very possibly represents a violation of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Despite that, today the ADL is the largest non-governmental trainer of law enforcement in the US and is closer to the FBI than ever." Which brings us to the question of a key asset in the black community, the Reverend Al Sharpton. He has admitted spying on others for the FBI in the 1980s, describing his role as cooperating with an investigation by using electronic recording equipment in a briefcase to secretly record conversations with targets of interest. He's perhaps the ADL's strongest advocate in the African-American community, regularly appearing alongside ADL leader Jonathan Greenblatt to support his statements. Less known about Al Sharpton is that for many years his show on MSNBC has been produced by Moshe Arenstein, a former intelligence officer in the Israeli military. The black community in the United States is being targeted.
David, that's a really huge number of individuals and groups being spied on, isn't it? I mean, and all this was done with the connivance of the FBI.
The connivance of the FBI going back way back into the century, into the 1940s. There was an involvement there from the 1940s. The ADL tried itself to, first of all, to infiltrate the FBI, and that was rebuffed back in the 40s, but then they started to work very closely with them, and all the way through this period they've worked closely with them. In the 60s, the files now show, there was some kind of questioning about what that, and we saw in the previous film, the whole question about the relationship with Israel, and the FBI said, well, of course, these people are giving this stuff to Mossad, but this is a bit dodgy, and it probably is against the law, but nevertheless, they continue to collaborate with them. It was only in the 1990s that the investigations first happened in San Francisco of some of the activities where these stats came out, the thousands of people, the hundreds of organizations which were spied upon. What's interesting about this is the way in which that relationship continues to this day. They advertise that they work together. And really what we should be seeing is a move away from the FBI and law enforcement working with the ADL, and more the ADL being monitored by the FBI, because they're clearly working on behalf of a hostile foreign government. And there seems to be no recognition of that in law enforcement circles in the US, but there is in civil society.
Mm. Well, Jared then explained how the ADL's influential position at both YouTube and PayPal in vetting content and access to these services actually affects those platforms.
Well, I don't think the ADL has, from my vantage point at least, I don't think the ADL has any more of an undue negative influence than the platforms already in their commercial organization have from the outset. What the ADL does is play its role within that broader apparatus of pro-imperialist, pro-Zionist, pro-capitalist, white supremacist workings, to limit discussion and narrow discussion to what is considered sanctionable or acceptable to those politics. So they fit right in, is sort of the point that I'm getting at. Without the ADL's involvement, there would still be plenty of white supremacist and pro-capitalist and imperialist narrowing of discussion, whether it's through the advertising arrangement, whether it's through outright surveillance and suppression of radical politics, or the like. So here the ADL exists really to play the role among a certain class and ideology of Jews initially and Zionists more broadly to limit the discussion where even among the Jewish community, to make sure that radicalism doesn't go too far or get too much of a platform even among Jews. So that is clearly their tactic historically, and have used the anti-Semitic trope and the fear of the rise of a new black anti-Semitism for decades now to target, in this case, all forms of the black left, to make sure that whether it's on Twitter or historically in newspapers or magazines or elsewhere, that those politics remain equally narrow.
David, the ADL published a hair-raising paper back in 1992 entitled The Anti-Semitism of Black Demagogues and Extremists. I mean, who did they single out in that report?
Well, they didn't single out in the sense of a small number of people. They had a huge list of black politicians and indeed black cultural figures. So amongst the black cultural figures was Ice Cube, the rapper from N.W.A., also, of course, the rap group Public Enemy were singled out in this. You can see it on the screen there. The notion of a black demagogue, extraordinary, really that they could have got away with that. This is a file which is publicly available and has been disclosed through FBI document, Freedom of Information documentation. So there's a real sense there which there any of the key black cultural figures or black political figures were being targeted by the ADL in a way which is really quite, from this distance, clearly racist. But what's interesting about this document is that they say in there that they target extremists. And of course, if there are Jewish extremists, we will target them as well. But this whole document comes about as a result of the famous Crown Heights riot, which happened as a result of a Chabad rabbi jumping a red light and smashing into two young black kids, one of whom died, and that set off the riots. Yeah. And there's no sense in any of this that Chabad, which as we know from previous programs, is itself an extremist organization. And there's never been an occasion when the ADL has ever denounced extremist Jewish organizations. And that's partly because it is itself an extremist organization. Mm.
Well, Jared also responded to the claims about the ADL being useful to the FBI as part of its clandestine counterintelligence program known as COINTELPRO, much of which was actually illegal. Jared described some of the background to this mysterious program and explained how the ADL could have been useful to it.
Illegal once upon a time, but post 9/11 in the United States, most of everything that was done under the counterintelligence program is now perfectly legal. Making the whole discussion of legality almost moot. But the reality is, again, as I've been just trying to say, the ADL is designed in its own origin in politics and focused as, again, a Zionist, imperialist, pro-capitalist, white supremacist, settler colonial organization. It fits right in with what the politics and the goals of the broader state itself. And certainly the FBI has no problem in promoting those politics and ideas, whether among Jews, Arabs, Black Americans, Christians, whomever else. And that's exactly what they've done and will continue to do. So if the ADL presents itself as being willing to be used, in effect, to take advantage of the actual suffering of Jews historically and in real time, to become part of a very conservative and anti-human apparatus, well, then they'll be put to that use. And to that extent, that's exactly what the ADL has and continues to do, and why they will more than likely continue to find a happy home in allegiance with the FBI and other, again, members of that apparatus, more broadly speaking.
David, tell us about Al Sharpton, who was mentioned in the film there. He's a favored voice, isn't he, of the ADL?
Yes, but he hasn't always been. And in this document we were just talking about a minute ago, he was one of the key people who was targeted by the ADL as being a black demagogue, an anti-Semite, who'd led what they called a pogrom against the Jews in Crown Heights and the Crown Heights riots. And of course, now he's not. Now, so what happened? Well, what happened was that his organization was penetrated. And we saw in the film there the relationship with his producer, who's former Israeli intelligence. But really, what we're seeing is part of a more general process whereby the Zionist organizations try to penetrate anti-racist organizations to bring them on side so that they won't criticize Israel, they won't stand up for Palestinian rights. And if they'll do that, then anything is fine.
Mm. Well, finally, we asked Jared what he made of Sharpton's TV show actually being produced by a former agent of Israeli intelligence.
On some level, I think it matters for sure, and I think it's something that is not to be ignored or set aside. But I think it's on some level even unnecessary to make note of, given the politics of Sharpton and his show. And Sharpton has made clear for a long time that he has been part of the rebranding of black radicalism, excuse me, as something that is supportive of black capitalism, liberal to conservative politics, et cetera. In other words, the rebranding of the actual revolutionary politics of a real life Dr. King as something that would be acceptable to mainstream American news and media, which is, to me, all the evidence we would need of the kind of politics that he is there to represent and has been there to represent. The added fact or note that you mentioned about his producer is, again, interesting and I think adds important context, perhaps, but ultimately isn't that important given the observable, demonstrable, performative politics that Sharpton has been and continues to represent.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time today. I hope you've found the program informative. Thanks to our guests, Professor Jared Ball, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
the limelight.
Armed police used tear gas in clashes with football fans in Paris on Sunday night, 18th of December, after France's World Cup defeat to Argentina. Around 14,000 police officers were on duty across France to keep order. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. Armed police used tear gas on the streets of Paris on Sunday night, 18th of December, after disorder broke out following the World Cup defeat to Argentina. Football fans descended en masse to the streets of the country's biggest cities, Paris, Lyon and Nice, after the game. Police officers quelled the disturbance in the Champs-Élysées as flares were ignited and fireworks went off. Meanwhile, similar scenes played out in Madrid, Spain, as jubilant Argentinian fans flooded the streets of Madrid in celebration. Pictures showed a huge crowd of fans in white and blue in the city's main square celebrating after their team defeated France. However, some clashes broke out with police, with photographs showing armed officers beating supporters with batons. One man was seen being ushered away by police. Around 14,000 police officers went on duty across France on Sunday night, 18th of December, to guarantee security as Le Blues took on Argentina in the World Cup final. The Parisian security operation presented to the French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin publicly on Friday, saw a concentration of forces in Paris, where huge crowds were expected in the event of a victory. The Champs-Élysées Avenue was the scene of vast celebrations during France's previous World Cup triumphs back in 1998 and 2018, with 600,000 people cheering and dancing there 4 years ago. The avenue was closed to traffic on Sunday, and 2,750 police officers were stationed in the vicinity. Police were on their guard for troublemakers after around 40 far-right sympathizers arrested on Wednesday evening as they attempted to join a crowd of revelers after France beat Morocco in the semi-final. They had come to start a fight, the French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin told reporters. The aftermath of last Wednesday's game was also marred by the death of a 14-year-old teenage boy in the southern French city of Montpellier, who was hit by a car carrying supporters. The driver of a white hatchback involved in the accident is still being sought by French police. With concrete blocks painted blue, white and red, police had sealed off the Champs-Élysées to traffic in anticipation of it flooding with celebrating crowds on Sunday. People did gather and fireworks were fired into the sky when France twice equalized, but they were left with a feeling of disappointment. By contrast, hundreds of thousands of Argentinian football fans poured into the sunlit streets of Buenos Aires on Sunday, ecstatic after a nail-biting victory on penalties in the World Cup final over France made the South Americans world champions for the first time since 1986. In a tense and roller coaster match played in Qatar in front of some 88,000 fans, Argentina, led by star Lionel Messi, took home its third World Cup after beating France, the defending champions, 4-2 on penalties after drawing 3-3 after extra time. British newspaper The Sun has also covered the same story. Riot Corps tear gas fans in France on Sunday night as clashes erupted across the country after Argentina's sensational World Cup win. Thousands of football fans poured into the streets of Paris, Nice and Lyon after France lost to Argentina 4-2 on penalties in Qatar. Riot Corps clashed with fans on the famous Champs-Élysées Boulevard in the French capital as flares were lit up and fireworks hit the skies after the tense game. In Lyon, riot police reportedly fired tear gas on football fans as violence broke out in the city. Shocking video footage showed chaotic scenes as supporters draped in flags hurled rocks, bottles and fireworks at police officers before officers fired tear gas on the crowds. Cops could be heard yelling "turn around" at rioters as water cannons reportedly moved in to break up the crowds. Another video clip showed a group of fans pummeling cars with rocks and rubbish before riot police chased them down the street. Dozens have been arrested in the city, according to reports. French police also responded to unrest in the Mediterranean French city of Nice on Sunday night, 18th of December. French newspaper Le Figaro reported clashes took place with police and garbage bins were set alight in Nice. Video footage shows a heavy police presence in central Nice. A fire can be seen burning on a rubbish-strewn street. Riots have erupted across Europe after several World Cup games in recent weeks. Last Wednesday, a 14-year-old teenage boy was killed when violent clashes erupted across France following their World Cup victory over Morocco. Police were pummeled by fireworks in Paris as thousands poured into the streets to celebrate after France beat Morocco 2-0 to reach the final. Shocking video footage showed chaotic scenes as fans bombarded riot corps with a stream of fireworks before officers were forced to flee the line of fire. Another video clip in the French capital Paris showed police pushing back fans as they set off flares at the Champs-Élysées. Rowdy fans chanted as hundreds of cars paraded past the crowds, sounding their horns and waving flags from the windows. French corps said 115 arrests had been made in Paris by the early hours of Thursday morning, 15th of December, according to Le Parisien. In the French city of Montpellier, shocking video footage also showed fans chucking chairs, fireworks and rocks at riot police and climbing the landmark fountain in the city.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the future of Brazil with Brazilian author and journalist Pepe Escobar. But first, this brief analysis.
The events surrounding the recent presidential elections in Brazil could have been taken from the plot of a political thriller novel or a movie. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva emerged victorious in the second round of the elections, beating incumbent Jair Bolsonaro by a relatively small margin of 2 million votes in a nation of over 215 million people. He begins his third non-consecutive term as president of Latin America's largest nation, following years of judicial prosecution and incarceration on charges of corruption, charges which he eventually vacated by Brazil's highest court, allowing Lula da Silva to participate in the elections as the head of a multi-party coalition challenging right-wing incumbent Bolsonaro. These elections once again put on display the deep social and cultural divisions that exist in Brazil, rooted in its colonial history and the era of the U.S.-backed military dictatorship, which ruled the country from 1964 to 1985. Brazil is one of the founders of BRICS, accomplishing this with Russia, India, and China during the first period of Lula da Silva's presidency in the early 20th century as an important international organization challenging U.S. hegemony. Brazil is at a historic and strategic crossroads where it is on the one hand a key nation in the emerging new multipolar world, and on the other hand, the most important country in Latin America in which military and traditional economic elites have deep relations with U.S. security organizations who continue to wield influence in Brazil through these elites and who will do anything to prevent Brazil from being a fully sovereign nation outside of the U.S. orbit. The next 4 years of the Lula da Silva presidency will be interesting to see in terms of the level that Brazil is able to assert its full sovereignty in global affairs, contrary to U.S. pressures. And domestically, to what extent the economic situation regarding the tens of millions of people who live in poverty and the devastation left behind by the COVID pandemic can be alleviated.
Pepe Escobar, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
You know, Salam, and thank you for having me.
My pleasure, our pleasure. You know, this is very good. We were really hoping to do a program on Brazil, particularly after the elections, and we were hoping to do it with you. We always try to, when we're doing a subject, a country, we always try to find a person who's from that country to talk about the issues because, you know, it's a lot of the problems that exist in the media, in the global media today, is countries being talked about as opposed to the people from those own countries talking about themselves. And, of course, since our program is Insight, you know, we always gain a deeper insight of the country when you speak to somebody who's really from that country and knows that country and has lived the history of that country. So we're very happy to have you on our program today. You wrote a very interesting article in Asia Times following the elections, following the election of Lula, of President Lula, President-elect Lula, and the following elections. And in this, it was a short piece, but there was a lot of interesting little tidbits, a lot of interesting points, which, of course, you know, you didn't have the opportunity to get into them in the article. But I think it's a good place for us to start our conversation and see where we can go. And our goal is to really understand Brazil on a deeper level. This is always what we try to do in this program. You talked about, for example, that there are two Lulas. There's the domestic Lula and there's the international Lula. And you also talked about the historic context, or you made references, you didn't really get into it too deeply, about the historic context of what we're seeing happening in Brazil in the last maybe 20 years. Mm-hmm. And where I want to start with you is we need to go back in history, look at the fact that you talk about that Jair Bolsonaro, who was the president, who was the controversial president, as we know, in terms of a lot of the policies that he made, particularly as it related to COVID, but also his very, you know, enthusiastic support for Trump, his very enthusiastic support for Israel. Mm-hmm. You talk about not Bolsonaro as a person, but the Project Bolsonaro, which has been something that you talk about the military in Brazil having this project going on ever since you had Lula become the president in the early 21st century for the first time, a left-wing president becoming the president of Brazil for the first time since the early 60s, before the military coup. And I would just like to mention for our audience who don't know that there was a Brazil, the Brazil you grew up in, was the Brazil of a military dictatorship from 1964 to 1985. So before we get into Lula and what's going to happen now and what the elections are, let's start with this idea that that there is a Bolsonaro project, that there is maybe a deep state, maybe the power of the military is still very much real and alive, and their connections with the Americans and with the CIA, more than what we would think if we look at this kind of very cliche image of Brazil, you know, with soccer and Copacabana and everybody mm-hmm. having fun and being friendly. So if you could please get us started with giving us your insight about this part of Brazil.
Well, it's a wide-ranging question, and it's going to be very hard to put it in 5 minutes, but I'll try my best. This is a Hollywood trick. Explain the plot of the movie in 25 words.
Exactly.
So I'm going to use a few more to try to explain exactly. a very convoluted plot. Okay, we have to start in terms of modern Brazilian history. The most important fact is Brazil was a military dictatorship from 1964 to roughly 1985-86. That's a long, long time. It was one of the most sophisticated military dictatorships in the global south. Mm-hmm. It was not as bloody as in Argentina or in Chile because mm-hmm. it was much more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. And of course, there was a brainwashing of most of the Brazilian population because the military were selling the myth of the Brazilian miracle, which mm-hmm. happened to be economically a miracle, especially during the 70s when there was still low oil prices, etc. After the oil shock, of course, everything started to go down little by little. And in the 80s, they were completely lost, and they knew that they couldn't stay in power anymore without any justification whatsoever. So they engineered a transition towards democracy, which, in the words of the military generals who were still ruling Brazil, was slow, gradual, and very secure. This is their own mantra for mm-hmm. this transition towards democracy. And of course, the deal that they made essentially with the Brazilian politicians and ruling elites essentially is, okay, everything that happened these past 20 years, you don't touch it. This means you don't touch us. So that was the unspoken agreement between Brazilian elites, the politicians that they appointed, of course, mm-hmm. and the guys who would lead this transition, this this transition towards democracy. And of course, the military would be in the background, but monitoring the situation. In this interregnum after the post-military dictatorship years, starting in the 80s, and especially in the 90s, we have, of course, when Brazilian inflation was exploding to a level that even people in Iran and all across the global south cannot even imagine, something mm-hmm. like 3,000% a mm-hmm. year, which is something absolutely unimaginable.
Right.
Something had to be done. That's when the Real plan mm-hmm. came up, which was basically a parity of the new Brazilian currency, which was called the Real at the time, and the US dollar, 1-to-1. And so it was a restart of the Brazilian economy. It worked at the time because the bankers who coordinated the plan and the president at the time, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, sociologist, mm-hmm. They were completely protected by Wall Street, the international financial system, and Washington. They considered Cardoso one of them. Cardoso had a very close relationship with Bill Clinton, for that matter. And right. all the bankers, they had studied in American universities, all of them, right. with no exception. You know. So it was easy. So it was a seamless transition. And at the time, that was the second part of the 90s, especially, Brazil was a sort of darling internationally because they were following the Washington consensus to the letter. And of course, in terms of the internal situation, not much had changed. Mm-hmm. But then Lula tried to become president at least 3 times. He lost 3 elections. Mm-hmm. But finally, in 2002, he was elected. But of course, to rule, he had to make a lot of concessions to whom? The Washington consensus, Wall Street, international financial system, etc. But he had some margin of maneuver at the time. Don't forget that at the time, the empire was completely preoccupied or obsessed by its own designated war on terror, which was more like a war of terror, right?
Exactly.
And Lula, just to give an idea to all of you, Lula came to power 2 months before the invasion, the bombing and invasion of Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So in his first years, he had more or less, he could do something in terms of social programs, eradication of poverty, sustainable development, bringing millions of people out from being excluded from the system to becoming at least lower middle class, if not middle class, you know.
Right.
So this happened during, especially the first and the beginning of the second Lula terms. Lula was in power from 2002 to 2010. We've been talking about what, 30, less than 30 years. Brazil was a military dictatorship, was a failed economy, was a darling of the international system, and it became a model to the global south in terms of sustainable development.
Right.
So these were four major different phases in a matter of only 40, 50 years, you know. So now, and that will bring us to what Lula is inheriting now, which is a completely different situation compared to when he first came to power in 2003, 20 years ago.
Okay, so it's very interesting, Pepe, you were saying that we had this period in the first period where Lula was ruling, where you had actually very real social development, poverty alleviation, you had jobs being created, basically things that you would expect in a very wealthy, rich country such as Brazil with all the resources that it has, a government who is not necessarily even very communist or Marxist or very radical.
Not at all. Yeah.
Right. You're saying that basically he was able to sort of get this coalition going where he had to have people maybe with him who are a little bit more, how should we say, center-right or center.
Yeah.
But the result was that there was real change for a lot of the poor people in Brazil. It wasn't just, you know, something that was on paper. They really felt it. And then I want to go back to this idea that, like you said, the military is in the background. There's always somebody watching. There's always this point at some point where you can't really cross that line. And, you know, we see then the things that happened in terms of him being imprisoned and those issues, and also what happened with his successor, which was Dilma Rousseff, is if it was, for example, in a country like Turkey, you would call it a soft coup. You would call it you would call it, you know, as you know, in Turkey, they always have these. They have hard coups and they have soft coups.
Exactly.
Which, you know, when Erbakan became the prime minister following the Cold War in Turkey, he was Islamist. He came to Iran. And then, you know, immediately you had, letters being sent by the military and he was removed. So can we really say that what happened following the Lula era and then later with his successor, Dilma Rousseff, was in a way a kind of a soft coup?
No, it was a hardcore coup.
Okay, please go ahead.
Disguised as a soft coup.
Right.
And for many people, there was no coup at all. That's even more worrying because we could say almost half of Brazilian population, oh, there was never a coup. He was corrupt. He had to go to jail. Dilma was corrupt as well. And that's terrible because this is where we get to the massive fake news and disinformation campaign installing a cognitive dissonance among millions of Brazilians on everything that happened during the car wash corruption investigation, which was completely manipulated by, we can say, Brazilian fifth columnists, of course, but manipulated in the background by the Americans. Now we all know how it started, which was by the end of the Lula era. It started almost the minute Dilma Rousseff was elected as president in 2010. And the American campaign started in 2010 itself. And this is something that we later learned via WikiLeaks cables.
Please tell us more.
Exactly. WikiLeaks revealed... I think by 2015, years later, WikiLeaks revealed how the Americans started to spy on key institutional instances in Brasilia, Petrobras, everything tied to Petrobras, the Brazilian oil gas giant,
yes.
one of the top energy companies in the world, And even the personal phone of President Dilma Rousseff.
Right.
All that is known, documented. Everybody knows it since WikiLeaks first revealed it. So this was a concerted campaign by CIA, FBI, State Department, Department of Justice, Treasury, etc., because they knew, now maybe we have a wink link over there. Lula is not in power anymore.
Right.
So first we go after Dilma, and then we go after Lula. For that, we need a lawfare mechanism.
Exactly.
And that's where the car wash investigation.
Right. Just to explain for our audience, lawfare is when they use the legal system to attack, to
attack, demonize, and eventually imprison and put in jail.
It looks like a legal process that's very innocent.
It looks like a legal
process. But the reality is it's persecution in the worst case.
Absolutely, with the bogus evidence or no evidence at all, with the co-option of mainstream media, which in Brazil was massive. The whole mainstream media was against Dilma, and then let's put Lula in jail. Everybody, especially the largest media conglomerate in Brazil, Globo, which owns Global TV, which is probably the fourth largest, most powerful TV network on the planet after the three Americans, you know. Mm-hmm. So they have enormous power in the deep recesses of Brazil. Like, you know, they reach corners of the Amazon jungle that you don't even know they exist. But right. Everybody's tuned to the global newscast at 8 o'clock every night, you know, that kind of stuff. Right. So you have a corrupted Congress, corrupted judiciary, corrupted media, corrupted politicians, and in the background, of course, exercising plausible deniability always, the Americans. The whole American judicial lawfare system applied to the global South. And Brazil, for them, was a fabulous case because this was not a small African nation or a small nation in Southeast Asia. This was, at the time, a nation that was on the way to become the fifth largest economy in the world.
Right.
Which is what was happening during the Lula years and the beginning of the Dilma years, you know.
Right.
So, and of course, included in what the Americans always called our backyard. Because many of you probably know that the Monroe Doctrine, which is still going on since 1830, considers the whole of Latin America as the U.S. backyard. And Brazil is the top dog in Latin America. Everybody knows that, economically, mm-hmm. geopolitically, etc. Strategically, because it controls the South Atlantic, connections with Africa, you name it. So Brazil, you cannot afford, from the point of view of the American establishment and American elites and the American financial system, to have a Brazil that is relatively sovereign. I'm not talking about completely sovereign.
Right.
And that's what it was during Lula and in the beginning of the Dilma years as well. Okay, Dilma may have committed a lot of mistakes. That's another story. But the key story is that the engineering of a soft coup, as you mentioned, which was very well disguised because it was a hardcore institutional coup against Dilma, it worked so well that it took only 2 years to have her out. And that's where we come into the Bolsonaro phenomenon, because the Bolsonaro phenomenon started the minute Dilma was re-elected in 2014. This is essential to understand what happened afterwards and why we had Bolsonaro elected as president. 4 years after Dilma was re-elected, and 2 years after the coup against Dilma.
So please tell us a little bit more. So we have, she's basically following in the footsteps of Lula, and continuing the path. And then we see suddenly all these things happening, and she's gone. And then, you know, a few years later, we have this person, which, you know, we were joking before the program. You know, I said proto-fascist, but maybe we can just say fascist.
Yes.
Suddenly becoming the president, and we see a Brazil that's basically split in half, where you basically have 50-50 on both sides. So tell us what happened there.
I'm going to have to give you the short version, because it's an extremely convoluted process.
Right.
But, you know, the main lines, the guidelines of the whole thing is the success of using technicalities mm-hmm. mostly in Congress to basically impeach Dilma.
Right.
That happened in 2016.
Right.
At the time, the military and Brazilian elites linked to the international financial system and in a very clever way, posing as sovereignists, nationalists, but anti-system in their own words, but in fact defending the macro system, which is the rules-based international order, as the Americans themselves define it, right? So the military in Brazil, they pose as nationalists, and they're serving foreign elites. How they managed to pull that off tells you how sophisticated is their PR offensive and the conflicting signs that they are sending all the time, which in terms of a puzzle, mostly puzzled public opinion in Brazil, people don't, they cannot identify the signs anymore. They are completely lost in a semiotic jungle, you know, absolutely lost. So they start, they have a Brazilian flag, where they, you know, they go out in the streets with the Brazilian flag, defending a military product, which is the case of Bolsonaro, not even a general, a mere captain. And he became a captain because he was expelled from the army. And then he went up one rank, you know, a mediocre politician for 20-something years. And from one day to another, this guy is being incensed as the new salvation for the Brazilian debacle, after the years of Lula and Dilma, which were demonized to the hilt, of course, especially in terms of they are extremely corrupt. They stole, of course, they could never prove that Dilma or Lula stole were actual bank robbers on a state level. But they criminalized the Workers' Party where they came from. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are problems with the Workers' Party, but they were not a bunch of Al Capone thieves, you know.
Right.
So, but this, but the whole PR campaign, which obviously the whole infrastructure for this PR campaign was borrowed from the Americans, which have vast experience all across the global South of organizing regime change in a soft way.
Right. Yes, we know. Yes.
Really
yes.
Hardcore.
Yeah, regimes. Yeah. We know. Yeah. In Iran, we know.
In Iran, come on, you know better than anybody in the world Iran about that, yeah. Right? So the beginning of the Bolsonaro project, it's something very interesting in terms of the timeline.
Right.
He went to a Brazilian military academy only 1 month after Dilma was reelected. That was the end of 2014. She was reelected in November. In December, he went to this military academy and more or less informally launched a bid for the presidency in 2018.
Right.
And of course, the whole military brass was behind him. So he became, from day one, literally, their candidate for the next elections, four years later. And that's exactly what happened this 4 years later, because in between we had the crucial plank of the whole scheme, let's put it this way, which was to demonize and marginalize Lula, preferably forever. And that's how they concocted this absolutely bogus allegations that Lula.
So, excuse me, Pepe. So, in other words, they realized that if Lula is there, he would not be able to be elected because they would be facing a formidable opponent who's popular,
they were afraid that if Lula would run in 2018, they would win. And in fact, all the polls were saying that if Lula runs in 2018, this is after the coup against Dilma, every poll was saying he's going to win. And he was going
to
win.
Exactly. So in other words, they had to get rid of her. They had to get rid of Dilma, bring in some sort of an interim until 2018, some sort of
The interim was the horrible Temer administration.
Right.
Temer was the center-right vice president of Dilma.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Pepe Escobar? Contrary to the stereotypical image most have of Brazil, this geostrategically very important nation is in fact a socially and culturally deeply divided nation. The powerful US-backed army and traditional economic elites are still not fully capable of accepting that the majority of the poorer population in that country has gained significant political power after the end of the US-backed military dictatorship. This reality being most clearly manifested in the recent election victory and now third presidential term of former labor leader Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. In addition to this domestic state of affairs, Brazil is one of the key countries in the shaping of a new post-American multipolar world, being one of the founders of the BRICS Forum alongside Russia, India, and China, a forum which will experience further expansion in the near future with the addition of strategically important countries such as Iran, Argentina, Algeria, and Turkey. The next few years will show whether Brazil is capable of participating in the emergence of a new multipolar world as one of the new emerging global powers, or whether the US-backed Brazilian military and traditional economic elites will keep Brazil within the US sphere of influence by any means necessary. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
As China becomes more powerful, Washington, as it has done before and always do as an antagonizing force, tries to bully its allies into accepting what it dictates. Most of the time, these